But on this final talk of the retreat, I usually try and summarize what we've been doing and explain why we do it this way, and to make that connection that this is not just something you do in a retreat which has no bearing on your life outside, that it does seep into the life. And it may be not the fact that you can get nimittas or jhanas when you're busy working or at home looking after your family, but the attitudes which you learn here, the same things which lead to peace of mind, which lead to this beautiful sense of stillness and calm, are the very same attitudes which you use to solve and deal with the problems of your life. The meditation is almost like a scientific laboratory, where you learn how to deal with the obstacles and problems in your mind, and you find the same techniques which work for your meditation also work with the problems of your life. And little things like, you know, you all want happiness in this world, you all want sort of success, whether it's enough money or plenty of money to do what you need to do, to have a good relationship, to find someone to share your life with, and all these other goals of the world. Whatever those goals are, the sort of things which you learn here actually enhance those goals. It's really weird that there's many, many people who were monks with me, and when they disrobe, they become excellent husbands. Isn't that so, Danielle? Because she married one of my ex-monks. So, you know, we train them, get them really nice and soft and kind and peaceful, and you girls go and steal. Well, they make really good husbands. Yeah, isn't that the case? But where's Barbara gone? Oh, she's not here yet. Her son is another monk who got married. And so there's something about just the way, what you learn here makes you, number one, understand just the trick of relationships and how to deal with other people. And number one, you know, you lower your expectations. Because that's one of the problems with trying to find a partner in this life, have these wonderful expectations. Find the perfect guy, the perfect girl. And you should know by now, that doesn't exist. And if it did, if there was a perfect guy, do you think they would have you? They'd have someone much nicer than you. That's why I've been telling people all over the world. This is for those boys and girls who are not drop-dead gorgeous and hot. Because, you know, it must be really hard, you know, if you're sort of a guy who's not sort of really big and strong, if you're a girl who's not so sort of pretty or something. So I've been telling all the guys, so come on now, if you marry a very beautiful woman, if you marry her, you're going to be looking around your back sort of for the rest of your life. You'd be so jealous, because if she's that gorgeous, other men will fancy her as well. And you can never trust that when you're out working or off on a retreat, what your beautiful wife is doing back home. But if you marry an ugly girl, you have nothing to worry about. You can go on holiday, you can go on a retreat, nothing to worry about at all. And it's the same, you girls, if you marry a rich guy, a really wealthy guy, which a lot, you know, girls want, so they can, you know, have a nice life. But if you do marry a wealthy guy, then, as all you Chinese girls know, he can afford a mistress. And many of them do. They're very naughty. But if you marry a poor guy, he won't be able to afford a second wife. So you're safe for the rest of your life. You have no worries at all. So that's what I say to people. If you're going to marry someone, girls, you marry a poor boy. And boys, you marry an ugly girl. And you know, a lot of the boys and girls say, yeah, way! Because that gives them a chance to find somebody in life. But there's a lot of reason for that. There's a lot of logic behind that. It goes against common sense, but there's a lot of reason. So in these little things, how does a monk know that? Does it know such things? And yesterday, how does a monk, when I'm talking about, you know, looking after teenage kids, how do you know these things? And this is actually one of the things, the major thing which you learn when you meditate, is just how to get outside the box, as they say, so you can actually see what's really going on. Because sometimes in life, you know how busy it is? You're always having to deal with something which is really important. You really don't have any time to stop and see what's going on. And sometimes days, weeks, months, years go past, and you think, where does it all go? And you've been so busy for the whole life. You haven't been able to stand back and have a look to see what's going on and what you should be doing. One of the great things of coming to a retreat is you've got time. You've got all the time in the world for this last 9 days. There's no schedule very much other than lunch and breakfast. And there's nothing you have to do. You see the way that these retreats are run. There's no pressure on you to get up at any time. You have this wonderful sense of freedom. It's your time. No one else is going to tell you what to do. I'll be standing over you saying, get up, go to work, you know, do this, go home or whatever. It's all your time. And that gives you the sense of being able to relax, being able to be a bit free, and just being able to see what you're doing in life. The simile which I discovered, which was in Opening the Door of Your Heart, but it's a simile I want to bring up now, was that simile of the pyramids in the Yucatan Peninsula of Guatemala and southern Mexico. And this was in, a long time ago now, 43 years ago. I'm getting very old. This was in 1969 when I went to visit the United States, and you know, just before going to university, finishing off my school. I thought it would be a great time just to have an explore, but the United States was very boring. It was just, you know, the same as any other Western country. But Central America was interesting. It was a different culture. Yeah, it was poor, but it saw things and did things a different way. And when I was looking in the library at some of these books, of these immense pyramids in the middle of the jungle in Central America, they were built by the Mayan civilization. You all know about the Mayans now, because according to the Mayan calendar, next month's the end of the world. But don't worry, there'll be another retreat next year. It's not the end of the world. So when I saw those pyramids, I conceived a desire to go and see them, because they were really interesting. Much more interesting than seeing an Empire State Building or any of those big buildings which you can see in any city in the world. But it was hard to get to the jungle in those days. And this is an important part of the story. You know, from Guatemala City, you had to take a bus to the coastal town on the Caribbean coast of Guatemala. And there you could actually get a fishing boat, left usually about midnight. And it would take some supplies along the Caribbean coast to this river, which was the border between Guatemala and Belize. It was the border area, and my goodness, it was really remote. There was jungle on either side of the river, no roads, and that was, you know, where you actually did see the indigenous people in a dugout canoe, all naked, just like you were seeing in a Tarzan movie. It was exactly the same, but it was real. And going at the end of the river, maybe getting there about lunchtime, and then on the back of a truck, and to these very remote communities, and eventually, after 2 or 3 days, to this excavation area, archaeological area, called Tikal, in the middle of the Yucatan Peninsula. And there were these great pyramids, and because hardly anybody could get there, they weren't really concerned about tourists. So there was no guidebooks, there was no entry fee, there was no one even asked me who I was and what I was doing. You just had all these ruins to yourself. Now remember, I was English man, only just turned 18, I was a boy. Now what do males do when they see a pyramid or a mountain? Climb up it, yeah. Because it's there, we have to do that, we have to conquer things. That's the male stuff. So I decided to climb, and it's a long way up that pyramid. And on top of the pyramid, unlike the pyramids in Egypt, the pyramids in the Yucatan Peninsula had a little room on the top. Now, there's a wonderful thing, I never knew what those were, because I couldn't afford guidebooks. And number two, because I traveled overland, about 3 days of travel to get there, through jungle, there was something I never realized, but which was crucial to my understanding. If you, in those days, in jungles, there was only single lane tracks, you know, just dirt roads, you know, mostly sand. And as soon as they cut a trail through that jungle, within a couple of months, the trees had grown up and covered the roof of the track. So it was really going through tunnels. Now above you, you're going to see greenery. And the track, because it was in jungle, it swerved all over the place. What I didn't realize until I got to the top of one of those pyramids was for 3 days I hadn't seen the horizon. Now, you know, for you, you take it for granted seeing the horizon. Just go outside, you can see the sea and great distances. But if you live in a jungle, that's one thing you don't see. Distances. Especially not the horizon, not even the sky. You know, except just poking through the leaves of the jungle canopy. So when I climbed up that pyramid and got to the top, and the top was always just above the tree line. Now that just stunned me. It was the first time in 3 days I could see great distances. And it was very clear to me what the meaning of those pyramids were. If you lived in that jungle all your life, and that's all you knew, the first time you climbed up on one of those pyramids, probably led by some priest in some initiation ceremony, you'd see infinity for the first time in your life. Space as far as you could see. Now that would blow your mind. The whole idea of like space, the infinite, nothing between you and forever, that obviously has great spiritual connections, a metaphor for life. But even on addition to that, on top of that pyramid, I could see the track, which I spent all morning coming along from the nearest town, this beautiful town in an island in the middle of the lake called Flores, meaning flowers. And I could see the track, which, you know, it was like a bird's eye view, like a Google Maps. And that means you could get your connections. You knew actually where things were. You could see the lakes, you could see the rivers, you could see the tracks because you were above everything. And that obviously was the second part of the meaning of those pyramids. Because when you're high above the jungle, looking down, you can see the connections with things. You can see the bird's eye view and how all things are interconnected. And you could see your world, which when you're right in the middle of it, you just can't get that perspective. And I realized that that was the meaning of those pyramids in the jungle. So you could see the world in which you live, having gone out of it, above it, beyond it. You could actually see the overview, understand what this life is all about and where things go and where this road goes, where that road goes. But also you could see the infinite, the peace, the space in all directions, with nothing between you and infinity, emptiness. But in particular, for each one of you, this afternoon, tomorrow, you'll be going back into your jungle. You've climbed up the pyramid of meditation, and many of you have seen, you know, an overview of your life, you know, what you're doing in this world, your career, your relationships. When you're above it, you can actually see down and get a much better understanding of how it all fits together. So you'll be going back into your jungle tomorrow. When you're in the jungle, it's so hard to get perspective, but here, when you're in meditation, you can get that view about life and death, about your career, what's really important in this world. Because, yes, you will have goals. On this retreat, I said, have no goals, because I wanted to get out of that jungle where there's goals and things to attain and things to strive for. But when you go back, you will have your goals and things to strive for. But the most important is understand what the real goal is. When you're working, what are you working for? When you're having a relationship with another person, what are you doing that for? What's the purpose of relationships? Now, when you are doing charity, when you are looking after your kids, when you're looking after your old grandma who's very sick, what's the purpose of that for? What are you doing that for? It's not just culture. It's not doing this because that's what Chinese people have to do. You're not just lighting bowing because that's what Buddhists have to do. When you come to a place like this, you can get some understanding what this means, why we do these things. And obviously, one of the biggest things you do in your life is your career, working, you know, making money, just getting things. But stand back and look. What do you really need? One of the things I'm trying to teach people, and especially here in Australia, the people who have come from overseas, and you've seen, you know, Australia, you see that we actually have got the biggest houses in the world in Australia. I read that in an article. The largest houses, on average, in the world are in Australia. Such a waste of money and time. You can only be in one room at a time. And there was this story which somebody sent to me from a UK paper. A lady who'd won the UK lottery, it was £41 million, which is a lot of money. And as soon as she won that big prize, she sold her small apartment and bought one of these big mansions in the countryside, like these big manor houses. She only had that for 1 year before she sold it at a loss. And she sold it because in that big house, she would never see her family. Her husband would be in one part of the house, the children in another wing. Actually, even the children were separate rooms or separate suites of rooms. So throughout the day, she could hardly ever see the people she loved. And it was breaking up her family. We need to see each other, especially, you know, if we're having a nice family, you know, husband, wife, kids, even grandparents. When we see each other every day, yeah, we do rub up against each other, we do argue with each other, but at least we see each other and learn how to get on together and learn how to love each other. But when you're by yourself, you miss those social skills. You don't learn them. I just recall I was fortunate that I was born in a poor family. In what was called a council flat, not even a council house. The council house was the next stage up. We were just a council flat, a small apartment, and a very, very small, with my brother, my mother, and father. Because it was so small, I had to share a room with my brother all my life. And my goodness, we would fight, as brothers do. But I couldn't escape from him, and he couldn't escape from me. We slept in the same room together all our life. And so those of you who were here a couple of years, no, last year when we had my 60th birthday party here, my brother came. You see just how we got an incredibly wonderful close relationship together, you know, loving each other to bits. Why? Because we grew up together, literally in the same room. And sometimes I feel that people have lost such a lot in life if they have their own room. If they have a big house where they don't see each other. Because in those big houses, yes, we've got space, but we haven't got love. And many of you, especially those, you know, the elderly ones here, that, you know, maybe you grew up in a small house. Maybe this small little place in Asia where everybody was sleeping, you know, just three or four, five to a room. Sometimes you look back upon that. Yeah, it was in close quarters. But my goodness, you had family you could really rely upon. They loved each other. I mean, they were always there for you because you were always there for them. You couldn't get away from each other. So little things like that, you reflect upon. Why do we waste so much money building such big mansions? That's also in, you know, rich people in Indonesia and Thailand, they do the same. Why do they do that? Because they're just trying to impress other people. Look at my big house. But if you're smart and wise, you don't follow what other people do. When you actually meditate, you actually see what's really going on, and you make your own decisions. You don't just follow other people like sheep. One of our monks, he's now in, I don't know where he's gone now, but that's Wisarada. You know, a couple of you know him. He was a local boy. Now, his father was a farmer just in Mundijong, just, you know, around the corner from here. And he told the story one day. He went out into the paddock to collect the sheep. And there was a big thicket of bushes, like a circular piece of bushes. And he didn't know how this started, but the sheep had formed a circle around these bushes. And of course, they couldn't see the other side of the bushes. But because they formed a circle, they were walking around, one after the other, as sheep always do. They follow the one in front. But the one in front was following the one in front of that. You go long enough and that's the one at the back. It was a circle. And he said they would be still going around to this day if he hadn't taken one of them forcibly and got them out of line. Because that's what sheep are like, always following what other people do. And that's one of the other reasons during this retreat. I said, don't do things just what other people do. You know, do the kangaroo meditation. Sit on the other way. Do things differently, for goodness sake. Don't just be a creature which follows others. If you do that, you're basically dead. You're not alive. You're not really interested in life. You're just going through the motions. This is what I'm supposed to do, therefore I'm going to do it. You don't know why, but everyone else is doing it, so it must be good. It ain't good. So be a bit eccentric. That's the other thing which I've taught you here. A monk from the most conservative Buddhist tradition, the Theravada, is eccentric, who does all these great sadhus a different way every time, and tells jokes, and invents these new methods of meditation, like backwards breath meditation. You do that because that degree of eccentricity is being an individual, making up your own mind, and not just being a conditioned sheep. So you look at life, do I need that big house? Have a small house, and you'll have a wonderful family. A big house, you'll impress many people, you'll have lots of debts, and have to work your butt off until you're really, really old to pay everything off, and also you lose your family. Everyone will be independent. They won't know how to look after each other, which means when you need someone, there's no one there for you. So little things like that, this is a sort of insight which you get when you get above the jungle, and you can see things for yourself rather than just believing what other people say. You can live a much more simple life. And if you do, sort of, say, buy a car, don't buy an expensive one. The expensive ones are the ones which get stolen. The best thing to do is get a reliable engine and an old shell. Then it means that, you know, you can just park it anywhere. You don't even need to lock it because no one would steal that. Even thieves have got their standards. But the best one... The best car, you know, when one of our cars broke down, we were thinking of buying another car, you know, for our monastery. Now, I was really pushing for this, but the other monks wouldn't let me do this. The car I wanted to buy is a replacement for, I think it was a Volkswagen, which really stopped working, was a funeral hearse. Now, that is an excellent car to buy. Number one. If you're speeding or not wearing your seatbelts, no policeman will stop you. Because they'd be scared. Even in Australia, they're superstitious. They don't want to stop a funeral car. You can park anywhere. And number three, if I'm the traveller inside of it and I feel a little bit tired, you just go to have a sleep in the back. You're not allowed to do that in most cars, not even in a caravan, but a funeral hearse is no problem at all. And when we're not using it, we can hire it out and get some money back for funerals. So it was a wonderful idea, but just people just couldn't see it. So if you want to buy a new car, funeral hearse, that's the way. And if you go to the shopping mall, again, you can actually park in the disabled parking, whatever, because no one's going to give you a ticket. And just imagine just how much shopping you can get in the back of one of those things. So as a monk, you do think outside the box. Why? Because you live outside the box. And it's wonderful if you lived outside the box. That is another thing. In your career, whatever you're doing, isn't it the case in modern business, the thing which is really needed to get on is innovation? You do the same as everybody else does. The competition is so cutthroat. You have a hard time just getting by. But you innovate, you do things differently. Then you're going to actually be very successful in your life and in your career. That's the trouble with places like, you know, Thailand, Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia. Everyone just does the same. They find out what someone else is doing and then just imitate it. How about doing things a little bit differently? And how do you get that innovation, those new ideas? How you get those innovation and new ideas, I'm not joking here, is actually calming your mind down, being still. Because when you think, you always think in the same old ways. That's why I always tell you these thoughts are just coffins of the dead, which you carry around with you. You never innovate through thinking. You're just repeating the same old stuff in the same old ways. But when your mind becomes very still, when the thoughts stop, then these crazy ideas come up. These new ideas, there's been a lot of innovation. Comes not through thinking, but through being still. There was that famous mathematician who was just on a bus going to see the prehistoric caves in the south of France. When all these equations, he was just so peaceful and still, all these equations came into his head, and that's where he made his reputation from. There was another guy from Cambridge just after I called Josephson. He meditated and he discovered what was called the Josephson Junction in his meditation, which was the crucial thing which would make supercomputers running on close to zero degrees Kelvin. It was his invention, and he got that while he was meditating. There was a fellow who invented the mathematical formula which gives us MP3s, you know, the compression of data. He got that when he was asleep. Never through thinking. So much innovation, new ways of looking, comes when your mind is still. Not when it's thinking. Which is why that if any of you really want to be innovators in your life, in your company, in your business, stop thinking. Be still. And then you can see things in different ways. You're going to get outside of the jungle, above. You see above, and you can amazing just what you can see. That's why, you know, when I talk like this to business groups, they get very interested because it does make sense. Not only just lessening stress, and I've talked a lot about that, learning how to innovate, see things differently, and have an amazing life. Of course, the stress is one of the biggest problems in your life. Worrying about all these things which people have said to you, what you've done, rah, rah, rah. And the way I've taught this retreat, always, well, not always, but never scolding you, even though many of you deserve to be scolded. You don't do that. Why? Is it just because I don't want to make you upset? It's not. There's a deeper reason to the way I teach this retreat. Because if I scold you, you will scold others. And most importantly, you will scold yourself. Many times you come up and said, I slept in this morning. I say, you deserved it. You can see what I'm doing here. I'm taking away that terrible aspect of the human being which is so critical of themselves and so unloving. In all of those speeches and all those little comments of the interviews and other talks, I've not just been teaching you meditation, I've been teaching you how to make peace with yourself and at last love yourself. Such a simple thing to do. Such an obvious thing which people should do. But the last thing they do is love themselves. Yeah, you can love your partner, you can love your kids, you can love Ajahn Brahm, anyone, but not me. Not yourself. That's the toughest one to love. And that's the most important one to love. You'll soon be departing from this place and you won't see me. You could actually leave your husband, your wife, your kids will grow up and move to another part of the world. But you can never move away from yourself. Wherever you go in life, I guarantee this, when you're on the aircraft going home, you'll be there. Whatever country you live in, you'll be there again. Whatever you go next, you'll be there. Wherever I go, I'm always here. I can't get away from myself. Sometimes you try, but it doesn't work. Now, isn't it really important to have a sense of love to yourself? This is a good little story to tell your kids. That there was a story, I think this was, I think, from the Indian tradition. There was 2,500 years ago, whenever it was, whenever there was a teacher, the teacher would have a group of students and he would teach them everything. And when they were graduated, he'd get another set of students. And there was one teacher who would teach the whole lot. So there's one very good teacher and he had a group of students and they were almost about to graduate, maybe about 10 or 12 students. But he also had a beautiful daughter, one of these beautiful daughter stories. And everybody, all the students liked the beautiful daughter, and they always wanted to, you know, maybe one day that, you know, she would fall in love with them and they get married and live happily ever after, you know, these stories. So one day the teacher called a meeting and he said, "Yes, I know you all like my beautiful daughter, and it's about time she got married. But in our tradition, in our custom, I have to decide who she marries. And it should be one of you students. That's our custom. But I don't know which student I should choose to marry my daughter. And I know you all want to because she's very gorgeous and a very good girl. So I'm going to give you a test. And whoever wins this little competition will can marry my daughter. But it's not just a competition on obedience and wisdom. I also have another problem, and that is that I'm poor. And you know, when you get married, it costs a lot of money for the ceremony and also to set, you know, you up with a little house and all this stuff you need to get started in life. And I can't really afford that. So I thought a solution for both problems. For the next 7 days, he told his students, I want you to go into the village at night time and steal whatever valuable things you can. But please don't let anyone see you stealing. And whoever steals the most will win my daughter. And everything which is stolen, we give it all to the happy couple so they can have a good start in life. Now these students were shocked because the teacher was usually a very moral man and now he was asking them to steal. But they also had these vows of obedience which you don't have in schools these days. And also, they did want to marry her. So they all entered the competition. They would sneak into the village late at night, maybe early in the morning, 1 or 2 o'clock, when everyone was asleep, or when they'd left the house. And they'd steal many, many things. And then when they brought it back to their teacher, the teacher would keep a very detailed record of who stole what, but also from where. And after 7 days, when the competition was over, he called a meeting to announce the winner. And before announcing who'd stolen the most, he congratulated all his students for being so obedient, except for one. He said, "This one student hadn't stolen anything when I asked you to." So he called the student up and said, "Why did you not follow my instructions?" And the student said, "But Master, I did follow your instructions." "Well, why didn't you steal anything?" "Master, I did creep into the village late at night. I entered the house when they were fast asleep. And I saw all these valuables. I was just about to pick it up and steal it when I realized someone was watching. And you told us not to steal if someone was watching you." And the Master said, "Who was watching you when everyone was asleep?" And the student said, "I was watching me. That's why I couldn't steal." "Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu," said the teacher. "At least I've got one wise disciple out of all you stupid nincompoops." "Now," he said, "you can take all the goods back to the village. They won't scold you, arrest you, or beat you. This was planned a long time ago. They expected you. A lot of times they were pretending to sleep, although they heard you, noisy thieves. Take them all back. They won't harm you at all, because this was part of the test. And the one student who was wise, who followed my instructions, who couldn't steal when no one was watching, because he was always watching himself. That's why he couldn't do it. And of course he said, I'm wealthy enough to look after both of you. And you, my wise student, if you're that wise, you would never do anything wrong. You'd never just have a mistress, thinking that no one's seeing you, because you're seeing you. Therefore, you're the right guy for my daughter. So they got married, and of course, they lived happily ever after. And with a guy like that, he probably did live happily ever after. But what the point of that story was, is that you're always looking over you. You can't get away from you. So it's really important to learn how to love you and be kind to you. And just like I've been treating you, see if you can treat yourself. Now, if you're tired, sleep in, tell yourself, I deserve this. You know, you were tired, that's all. If you make a mistake, it doesn't matter, I make mistakes, we all make mistakes. Don't be so hard on yourself. Have this beautiful sense of acceptance and peace. Not only does that work in meditation, but it also works in life as well. You will find all of those stuff which you've been carrying around for years, you can let go of. Interesting. When I keep on telling people to let go of the past and let go of the future, you know, the two bags, similarly. Why can't you do it? It seems to be such a simple thing to do. Let go of the past, don't worry about the future. One of the reasons is because you don't love yourself. You don't think you deserve it. You don't think you deserve to have some peace, some happiness, some freedom. It's a crazy, crazy, crazy thing. Many years ago, there was a nun, a Western nun, meditating for the range retreats at Bodhinyana Monastery. And she was getting some really nice meditation. She was getting nimittas, but she just could not get into the jhanas. And I was obviously, you know, giving her interviews. And I was really sort of dumbfounded. She was doing everything right. Everything was coming together. She understood the instructions, but she couldn't make that last step into the jhanas. So I remember one interview, I asked her, I said, what's going on? Why? She says, I found out I don't think I deserve to be that happy. She was being honest, but my heart sunk. Oh my God, you deserve to be happy. What's going on? And I realized that was the first time I really saw that that is a problem with so many people in our world. Whether it's in your work, you keep on stuffing up. Subconsciously, you do it. Because you don't feel you need to be, you don't feel you deserve to be successful. You have a nice relationship, a really great guy, a nice girl, and you break it up. Why is that? Because you don't think you deserve happiness. You destroy it. You start getting to some deep meditation, it's really beautiful, and you stop. Because you don't think you deserve happiness. Now that is a very powerful psychosis in our modern world. And the reason is because you've been taught that since you were kids. Anyone who comes from a Catholic upbringing, that is beaten into you. You're a sinner, you're hopeless, don't even think you can be happy. And that is for many other cultures as well. That, you know, we're just so put down. The idea of being free and being happy and enjoying your life is something you say, no, that can't be right. Why not? So in this retreat, hopefully you've learned, or at least been encouraged a long way, to give yourself permission to be happy. Allow happiness to come. When it comes, don't destroy it. Enjoy it. It's not something going wrong. Something must be wrong. I'm happy. No, enjoy it for goodness sake. You deserve it. You've made it. It's happened. It's your karma. Enjoy it. So the little bit of praise and encouragement which I've been giving you in this retreat is not just for your meditation, it's for your life. very good. You're having happiness. Very good, the relationship's working out. You're having a good time together. Very good, you're healthy. Very good, whatever's happening. If you can remember that, you'll have a much more positive life. And I don't say this because I'm compassionate. I'm saying this because I'm selfish. I get too many people come to me with their problems. I just want to have an easy life myself. So when you guys are okay and having a good time, no problems, no problems with your kids, with your husband, you leave me alone. It's just pure selfishness, that's all. No, it's just general compassion as well. And you can actually see that the way we do this, you just make peace, be kind, be gentle. And there are times in your life when things are very difficult, painful, you're sick, things are going wrong, everything is falling apart. And that happens very often in life. Now you know what to do. There's no one in control, driverless bus, you just go and sit there and start complaining. Yeah, you get out of there eventually, it doesn't last. You know, whatever happens, it all passes. Either you get better or you die. You never stay sick for that long. Whatever happens, it passes. So those little pieces of information which you learn here, they really help you in your life when you get outside. It's not, life is not the problem. It's not the difficulties, the happiness, the success, the failure in life. That's not the problem. It's the attitude you have towards life. Asking from life what it can never give you. That's the problem. So when you're in meditation, you actually understand what life can give you, what it can't give you. And you adjust accordingly. You can never expect life which is always going to be healthy without any sickness. You can't expect life to go on forever. You're going to get old and die. You can't expect always to hear new jokes on an Ajahn Brahm retreat. You can't ask for things which life can't give you. So when you adjust to what life can give you, in other words, you know how to make peace with these things. Be kind, not just to people, not just to yourself, be kind to life. And be very gentle. You find you just don't get angry anymore. You become a soft, peaceful, beautiful person who goes through life with hardly any pain or suffering. Because you don't ask from life what it can never give you. And those are things which you take out there into the world. Little things which you learn in meditation, which when you go out, the attitudes are what stays. And those attitudes which you live your life with, it means that those attitudes get strengthened. So the next time you come on a retreat, you're way ahead. You've got the right attitude. How to make peace, be kind, be gentle, not to be a fighter. But to be someone who could be at peace with things, be in harmony with things, even harmony with things which are unpleasant. And that attitude is what will make you a great meditator. I discovered this in my early years as a monk. It was really weird. I'd always been a monk who was, maybe too compassionate, always helping other people, looking after the other monks in the monastery. So one of the jobs I did, which took a lot of time, was doing all the visas for all the Western monks in the monastery in Thailand where I was, which was a lot of work. And I did that because I thought these monks, because they didn't have to worry about the visa, they could carry on meditating. They didn't have to go to Bangkok and the immigration department and queue up and put all these visas in and write out all these forms. And so I was actually doing a lot of work for others. But then when we came together again, and these have been monks who've been up in the mountains meditating by themselves. And I started to just ask, how's your meditation going? And it became quite clear to me, my meditation was far better than theirs. And I couldn't understand that. How come you've had all this time to meditate, and I've been busy looking after you guys? How come my meditation is much deeper than yours? After a while I realized it's not the time you spend meditating, it's the attitude you have. It's how you meditate. And my meditation was always letting go, doing what was needed, just making peace. There's a lot of kindness in my practice, even from those early days. That's why when I stopped all that work, the attitudes I had built up were so strong, and making peace, being kind, letting go, that my mind just went into deep meditation very, very quickly. So even though you may not be sitting on a cushion when you go to work, even though you may have a very busy time before you can get on your next retreat, it's the attitude you build up while you're working. Those are the crucial parts of meditation. Just being aware in the moment as much as you can, not carrying too many burdens. Someone talks to you, you let it go straight away. You're the dustbin with a hole in the bottom. You don't keep things. Now is the most important time. This is the place your future is being made. Spend more time in the present moment. Don't worry about the future. Good, bad, who knows? So no need to worry about it. You miss your flight, who knows? Good, bad, who knows? Remember that story of this guy who came here years ago? He said he was doing business in Bombay at that time, Mumbai these days. Having finished his business, he got a cab from his hotel to take him to the airport for his next flight. The cab driver, this Indian guy, he obviously was just a poor guy, just came into the city because he didn't know the way to the airport. Imagine a cab driver not knowing the way to the airport. So he got lost in the streets of Mumbai, and the clock was ticking, and he was getting afraid he might miss his flight. And he's still lost. This business guy was getting more and more angry at the driver. The driver was just getting more and more stupid. And he had one hope left, and the hope was that the flight would be delayed, which was actually very common in India in those days. Things were always going late. But when he actually found the way to the airport, he realized for once the flight had taken off on time. Because he actually saw it take off. He saw the tower, that was his flight. It was taking off. Damn it, you stupid driver. Now I've missed my flight because of you. And then as he was scolding the driver, he saw his flight come down. It crashed with all people on board dead. Wonderful driver. Thank you so much. You're the best cab driver in the whole world. And that changed his life. Now, I get angry sometimes. We get angry at people and actually they save our life. That's why that story, good, bad, who knows? So those are the wisdoms which mean whatever happened to you in your life, you don't get so angry. You get dumped by your boyfriend. You know, you lose all the money on the stock market. You know, you get cancer. The attitude totally changes. So when the doctor says your cancer is terminal, what do you say? Very good. Very good. Now, this is what you learn here. That's what you learn over there. You got cancer anyway. Getting upset about that, is that going to help? You go, I got cancer, I'm going to die, what am I going to do? This is terrible. Is that going to help? That makes it worse, for goodness sake. So you just say, very good, got cancer, and you're improving your chances of survival. So it's just the attitude problem, and it's the attitude which you learn here on these retreats. You go away, yeah, you won't have as much time to meditate, but you'll have been brainwashed over the last 9 days in attitudes of making peace, being kind, being gentle, just letting things be. This is good enough. It's all very good. It's just life. You're just a passenger. You're not the driver. You know, you can't chase things. You stop and things come to you. And all this control freak business, it just makes life just so unpleasant. Living simply, living peacefully, having few desires. That's all you need. So those are the things which you learn here. So don't think, oh, I'm going home. It's all lost. No way. You have actually changed a lot. And people you go back to will realize that. They say, what have you been doing? What drug have you been taking? Over in Jhana Grove. They'll think that there's something going on here, which there is. You're learning just how to live life. Peacefully, kind, with a lot of fun. You know that sometimes people think that religion is just so boring. Ajahn Brahm, why on earth did you become a monk? you know, you got a good degree, you're a nice guy. Why did you do that for? Because I am having a good time. Does it look like I'm having a good time? That really spins people. How can you be so happy when you're a monk? You can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do something else. You can't do all these things which people think are fun. How come you have such a good time? And that's a really wonderful question. Why do people, you know, who are good monks, good nuns, why are they so happy? You answer that question, you know the secret of happiness in life. It's not what you have, it's not what you're doing, it's how you're doing it. The attitude problem. So this is what you're learning here. The attitude which creates peaceful and deep meditation, really happiness, a lot of relaxation, not asking for anything in the world, not having great goals, learning how to just to be and enjoy this moment, not being so critical, not asking from your boss what he can never give you, which is praise. Just always give you more work. That's what you can expect. Understanding all of that means you're at peace with life. You're not fighting battles you'll never win. And just doing that, right attitude, is a secret to a happy life. So there you go. This